From Sports Illustrated, we have Jay Jaffe, who has written a book called Cooperstown Casebook. And it's who's in the Baseball Hall of Fame, who should be in, and who should pack up their plaques. Jay, thanks for joining us. How you doing?
Hey, thanks. It's good to be here.
Well, you are one of the guys with the advanced statistics, and I was reading one of your columns, and you rated Grandel and a couple other Dodger catchers as the best in the league or up in the top of the league at stealing strikes. I didn't know there was such a metric. When did that come into vogue?
You know, that's something that Baseball Prospectus popularized in 2011. I think it was the winter of 2011 and 2012. Others had been doing it earlier, but basically it was one of the first advanced applications of the pitch effects data that that started coming out back in 2007, 2008. And what they found is that, you know, catchers, there really is a variable amount of skill when it comes to getting the call on those borderline pitches. Some catchers are very good. They kind of, you know, they know how to bring those borderline pitches in and frame them and look like, make them look like strikes, and others, their techniques aren't as good, and this is an actual skill. And you know what I was pointing out in this context was that that Yu Darvish was going to gain something by that, because in Texas, particularly Jonathan Lucroy, who once upon a time was actually one of the best in the league at this, his mechanics have gotten sloppy, and he's been the worst in the league this year. And the Dodgers in Yasmani Grandal and Austin Barnes have two of the top 10 in the league in the majors this year. So, you know, I think we saw a little bit of that last night when Darvish just mowed down the Mets. It was interesting. I was listening to Grandal talk in the Dodger clubhouse after the game, and he was saying, there were times when, you know, he threw a borderline pitch and got the call, and he smiled because he wasn't used to getting that call, and that just gave him more confidence to work around the edges and expand the strike zone. And I thought that was very interesting. I think it was indicative about the advantages that Grandal Darvish is going to have in moving to the Dodgers, who are obviously just red hot right now.
Yeah, and on the other side of things, the Mets pitcher, who DeGrom was annoyed at a lot of pitches that looked to be borderline that he didn't get the call on, and it looked like in the early going it might have affected him somewhat.
Yeah, it was obviously a tough night for DeGrom. 81 pitches through three innings. You know, you're used to seeing him be so much sharper than that. It just wasn't his night. You know, it happens, but we'll see if he can gather himself. I suspect he can. He's been pitching fairly well lately.
You know, and the approach of the Dodger hitters was something too, because it just seemed that they would, you know, get two strikes, foul off pitches. I mean, they just seem to be such good situational hitters. And I'm wondering, you know, it seems to be team-wide. And I know because the Dodgers are so good this year, we're looking for accolades and reasons, but their approach at the plate seems to be really, really good.
Yeah, you know, they've had a lot of success under their new hitting coach, Turner Ward, who's really, I think he really seems to have instilled the idea of going up there with a plan. You know, the dividends definitely have been shown with some of those hitters. I mean, some of them were already very selective hitters, but you know, and they've come up through the system developing that. But the one that's really impressed me is Yasiel Puig. I mean, he has just been so much more selective really the last couple of months than before. Far fewer, you know, first pitch ground outs and pop ups, just much more competitive at bats lately. And that's translated for the whole team. I think there's just this incredible confidence up and down the lineup that they are, you know, that they're going to work the count, put the pitcher in a hole and get that big hit, or just keep the line moving for the next guy. They've just got so many weapons. That's why they're on this historic roll, 42 wins in their last 50 games.
Let's talk a little bit about the book, Cooperstown Casebook, and you've come up with some different kind of metrics, because we've talked about, oh, you know, this guy was great, but he didn't have a long enough career. There are no hard and fast criteria for the Hall of Fame. It used to be, well, he hit 300, he had 3,000 hits, he had 500 home runs, you're automatically in. But tell us about some of the new metrics that you think should be considered for Hall of Fame voting.
Okay. Well, this is... This is my system called JAWS for the Jaffe Wins Above Replacement Score. And I started developing it back in for the 2004 Hall of Fame ballot when I was at Baseball Prospectus. And, you know, at the time what I wanted to do was to take this all-encompassing value metric, wins above replacement player, that had been introduced at Baseball Prospectus the year before, which estimates a player's not only his offensive skill but also his defense and base running, and adjusts for the scoring level of the time and also his ballpark. The idea being that if you look back across, you know, more than 100 years of baseball history, the players who are in the Hall of Fame played under such variable conditions that it's very difficult to do an apples-to-apples comparison. You know, there have been times throughout history that getting 3,000 hits or 500 home runs has been much easier. Obviously, we saw, you know, the recent so-called steroid era. 500 home runs has become kind of a marker that's, you know, I think a bit tarnished in some ways, or at the very least diluted, just because of the frequency with which players are meeting it. Whereas 300 wins has now become a rarity because of the way that the role of the starting pitcher has changed. So what I wanted to do was to see, what if we look at these Hall of Famers not in terms of the milestones that they achieved and you know, the 300 batting averages and things like that, but in terms of the value they provided their teams, and see where the line is in terms of the average player, and then identify on the ballot who the players that are above average are with respect to the Hall of Famers. And that's basically what JAWS is, using wins above replacement both on a career axis and on a peak axis, because some players are in the Hall not for, you know, sticking around long enough to approach those milestones, but for burning brightly but briefly. I'm thinking of Sandy Koufax is a perfect example, Hank Greenberg, Ralph Kiner, who led the National League in home runs in his first seven seasons and was done, I think, after 10 or 11 seasons. So the metric has caught on. It's been tweaked a little bit over the years. And it's gotten to the point now where it's on Baseball Reference. Every major player's page, his JAWS score is there. And it's actually used by many voters when they fill out their Hall of Fame ballots. I'm not saying they're slaves to it, but it has, you know, it's got some big names who use it to help them, especially fill out those last few slots on the ballot when there's eight candidates who look fairly similar to them and they want to pick the best two or three or something like that. So I'm very flattered at that. This book is the culmination of my research. It's not just about JAWS. It's also just about how the Hall of Fame got to be the way it is, and the battle to get these advanced metrics into the Hall conversation in the mainstream.
Jay, let's get a specific example a lot of people listening would relate to, and that's Don Mattingly, who mm-hmm. had some tremendous years. His back issues shortened his career and affected how good he was toward the end of his career. How do you view Don Mattingly with your system?
Well, you know, what I see in Don Mattingly, first of all, is a guy who obviously he played parts of 14 seasons, but he was done at age 34. Historically speaking, since World War II, there are not a lot of guys who've gotten in by retiring in their mid-30s, you know, even due to injuries. Ryan Sandberg, Ron Santo, Sandy Koufax, those guys come to mind, but those are the exceptions rather than the rules. So what I see in Mattingly is a guy who, you know, he hit .307 during his career, and with 222 home runs, certainly, you know, very nice, solid stats, for most of a career, but when I measure him out, he produced 42 career wins above replacement. The average Hall of Fame first baseman produced 66. I'm skipping the decimals here. Decimals don't make good radio.
Sure.
So, you know, he's about 33% short in value relative to the Hall of Fame first baseman. Now, his seven-year peak, his best seven seasons at large, is stronger. He produced about 36 wins over those seven seasons, about five a year. But the average Hall of Fame first baseman produced 43, about six per year. So basically what that tells me is even at his best, Don Mattingly did not have enough great seasons to measure up to the Hall of Fame first baseman. And really that's kind of what the voters felt as well. You know, Mattingly was being voted on really before before this metric was widely accepted. And he, you know, only in his first year did he even get more than 25% of the vote. You need 75%. He was down in the single digits in some years and hovering around, really around 15% for the duration of his candidacy, and then below 10% in his last couple of years.
Compare that to Keith Hernandez.
Okay, Keith Hernandez here. Keith Hernandez has produced tremendous defensive value over the course of his career. I think he's either first or second in the position in terms of the, you know, our estimate of how many runs he saved in the field. I have Hernandez here at producing 60 wins above replacement over the course of his career. That's still a little short of the average first baseman in the Hall, but not by much. He produced 41 over his seven-year peak. And again, the average for the Hall of Fame first baseman is 43. He's a lot closer to the conversation. And I have him as the 19th best first baseman of all time, ranked by Jaws. Now, there are other things you'd maybe want to consider in that overall ranking, like his postseason impact, his awards, and things like that. But as a first cut mechanism, knowing that he is, one-third of the Hall of Fame first baseman, that still tells me something. I think he's just a little short, but to me, he's pretty close, and I could certainly see voting for him based on the intangible importance of his defense. You know, his ability, his range, and ability to cut down the sacrifice bunt and turn it into a force play across the diamond. You know, we just saw a guy who kind of revolutionized the position, and I think is, you know, maybe one of the reasons why we've seen fewer sacrifice bunts over the year, because you've got somebody who's that adept fielding. You know, like Mattingly, though, he was done in his mid-30s, which I think made it really hard for him to accumulate those counting stats. He had that kind of non-traditional power profile, just 162 career home runs. We expect more from our first baseman, within the Hall of Fame. Between that and not playing more than 100 games after his age 33 season, he faced an uphill battle. And when you look at the voting results, only twice in 9 years did he even break 10%. I think he deserved a much closer look than that. I think he's kind of, for me, on the borderline, in or out of the Hall of Fame. But, I wouldn't be surprised if someday one of the small committees elects him, because I think he definitely deserves a closer look.
Jay, only about 30 seconds left, so I'm putting you on the spot here. The most egregious non-entry in the Hall of Fame, a guy who belongs that's not in.
You know, the one who's really important to me is Minnie Minoso, black Latin American pioneer outfielder, one of the best players in the 50s. Career got off to a slow start because of the Negro Leagues and because of the color line, and he was stuck in the Indians farm system for a couple years too. Just a fantastic career and deserves a closer look.
Okay, Jay, always a pleasure. We'll have to do it again sometime. We always feel like we've only scratched the surface when we talk to you. You got so much good stuff. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Jay Jaffe from Sports Illustrated. The book is Cooperstown Casebook, Who's in the Hall of Fame, Who Should Be In, and Who Should Be Packing Their Plaque.